Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, episode 5.15, In an Easy Agreement. By the time that September 1787 rolled around, all of the delegates at the Constitutional Convention were getting pretty eager to get out of there. The past few months had been an exhausting slog, filled with the constant back-and-forth bickering between the delegates. Several of the delegates had slipped away by this point, exhausted from the proceedings and needing to get back to other business. Plus, the Pennsylvania Assembly was about to get back to session, and they needed the convention out of their state house. Much like those delegates, this is our seventh episode on the convention, and, well, I too am pretty ready to move on. So that is what we are going to be doing today. We are going to wrap up the final remaining loose ends, see who is going to sign off on the new Constitution, and then begin delving into the second battle, that is ratification. So, without further delay, let's dive back in. Before we can wrap up our discussions on the convention and move into the debates whirling around ratification, first we have to figure out exactly how the Constitution should be ratified. This was not some small question either, because it really struck at the very core of all the questions that we've been talking about for weeks now. Questions over the power of the existing Congress, the question over the role of the states, the legitimacy of the convention itself, and really the legacy of the Revolution as a whole were all in question when it came to ratification. Now, everybody knew that ultimately, ratification was going to be in the hands of the states. However, that left a few key questions up in the air. First, how many states was it going to take to ratify the Constitution? Was unanimity going to be required? Or alternatively, would a simple majority get the job done? Even then, however, who exactly was going to do the ratifying? Would it be the state legislatures, or instead, was it going to have to be a separate committee? Finally, did the convention even have the legitimacy to scrap the Articles of Confederation in the first place? Congress had only begrudgingly approved the assembly to make suggestions for reform, not to blow the entire thing up. It was not exactly a very hard sell to convince anybody that the convention had not wildly exceeded its mandate. The first question that needed to be solved was to figure out just how many states would be needed to ratify the Constitution for it to take effect. One argument was that it should be unanimous. It should take all 13 states to ratify the Constitution. This, frankly, has a good deal of logic behind it. The Articles of Confederation required all 13 states to ratify. Shouldn't it therefore follow that to dissolve a government that required unanimous consent, it should also require unanimity amongst the states to dissolve it? There was a real sense that anything less than a unanimous consent for the new constitution would be tantamount to a second revolution. It would be the overthrowing of an existing government potentially against the will of the states who had agreed to it. The problem, though, is that if the decision was made by the delegates to make unanimity a requirement for ratification, then all of their work had been for nothing. Everybody remembered just how difficult it had been to ratify the Articles of Confederation. That government was held up for years before Benedict Arnold's invasion of Virginia scared everybody sufficiently to force through ratification. When it came to the Constitution, it was abundantly clear on its face that unanimity was not going to happen. At an absolutely bare minimum, everybody knew that Rhode Island, who hadn't even bothered to send a delegation, was going to vote the thing down immediately. Neither New Hampshire nor New York seemed terribly likely to ratify either. New Hampshire, although appointing a delegation, did not exactly enthusiastically send them to Philadelphia, and instead were really slow to provide that funding. By the middle of July, the New York delegation had up and left the convention entirely, with only Alexander Hamilton returning that September. With these things in mind, it is clear that unanimity was not going to happen. Everybody therefore agreed that should all 13 states have to unanimously agree upon ratification, the document was dead on arrival. James Wilson, recognizing this uphill battle, would motion for 7 states to be that key number, a simple majority. But this brought with it a whole other set of problems. Madison openly worried that anything less than unanimity would threaten the Union. After all, how could a union even exist if less than a majority of the people consented to its existence? Wilson argued that only states that agreed to the Constitution would therefore be governed by it. However, that left the delegates with a whole new slate of problems. Did that mean that any state that didn't agree was going to be excluded from the country? Maybe they could survive a state like Rhode Island not joining. But what if a more powerful state like Virginia decided that they were not going to get on board? Pierce Butler of South Carolina now took his chance and turned the argument back towards James Madison's primary concern coming into that convention. Butler argued that should the majority of the states want to move forward, then a small minority should not have the power to hold up the entire government. It was a return to that argument over the tyranny of the minority all over again. After a tense night of deal-making, the agreement was finally reached. It was going to take 9 of the 13 states to ratify the Constitution. Okay, great. 9 out of the 13 states. That decides things, right? Well, no. You see, as soon as the question over how many states were going to be required for ratification was over, the question shifted to exactly how the states should ratify the Constitution. On its face, this seems like an easy enough question. All of the states had legislatures that, being the good Republican governments that they were, represented the will of the people. So, then easy, just let the legislatures make the call on ratification. The problem was that the delegates knew handing the Constitution over to the legislatures was a risky move that could well kill the entire project. In Madison's view, state legislatures could not determine the fate of the Constitution because their power was to be held under it, and that only the people could make such a decision. Broken down further, the fear here was that the state legislatures might not be all that keen on voting away their own power and sovereignty to a national government. In Virginia, for instance, it seemed pretty unlikely that a man like Patrick Henry was going to enthusiastically clip his own wings. As George Mason put it, the state legislators are the creatures of their state's constitutions, and therefore cannot become bigger than their creator. The decision was ultimately made that the states would use individual state-level conventions for ratification. At the urging of Charles Pinckney, a letter would be sent to the people to explain the actions of the Congress. As the dust settled and the convention drew to a close, the decision was made. It was going to take 9 states to ratify the Constitution, and that such ratification should occur in conventions rather than in the legislatures. It was likewise decided that should future amendments be required, and as we are going to talk about shortly, they would be, these future amendments were going to require the approval of 3/4 of the states. It is likewise worth noting that the convention also went ahead and enshrined the process for admitting new states to the Union, to what was proposed in the Northwest Ordinance. Besides all of the requirements to become a state, the critical takeaway was that any newly admitted state was going to be joining as a full member of the club, with no distinctions between them and the original 13. After weeks of often contentious, grueling work, the proposed constitution made its way to the Committee of Style. This committee's job was to take the mess that was the constitution and make it look like something coherent and functional. For those reading it in the future, it was also critical that the debates that had so thoroughly ensconced the delegates for the past 3 months were nowhere to be seen. This particular committee was largely led by New York's Governor Morris, who took pains to make the Constitution as plainly clear as he could. As to this task, Morris managed to condense some 23 articles into a mere 7. He thoroughly purged the often overly verbose prose of the plan and cut as much unnecessary language as possible. He was largely responsible for writing the preamble with its bold and powerful opening, "We, the people of these United States." Of course, this preamble spoke directly to the nationalist tendencies of men like Morris. No longer were the people going to be of the individual states, but rather they were going to be part of something bigger, something greater. They were going to be part of the United States. More than anything, Morris and the Committee on Style organized the document. Article 1 was to address the legislature. Its position was no mistake. As we have already talked about, the founders viewed the legislature as being the very core of the new government. Granting broad powers to the new legislature, the document clearly laid out that the Congress was not to be limited merely to the powers enumerated in the Constitution, but instead granting Congress the power to make all laws necessary for the execution of the government. In other words, Congress had all the power that it needed to legislate, and that it should not be bound by words that were not explicitly written into the document. Article 2 covered the presidency. It gave the president the all-important command over the army, navy, and state militias. Although the president could make treaties, such agreements were still going to be subject to approval from 2/3 of the Senate. The president held the power to appoint all of the officers of the United States, again, pending the approval of the Senate. It laid out the oath that the president would need to take upon taking office, the process of impeachment, should a president need to be removed, and stating that from time to time the president needed to provide Congress with an update on the State of the Union. Article 3 dealt with the judicial branch. This particular branch was widely undeveloped and would take another decade to fully come together. It was not until 1803 that the Supreme Court had the all-important power of judicial review, that power to rule acts and laws unconstitutional. Today, that is the very core of what we think of when we think of the Supreme Court. Yet was something that did not exist until John Marshall willed it into being in Marbury v. Madison. Now, don't worry if you want to know more about this. I can assure you that I, a lawyer by trade, will be talking about John Marshall and Marbury in quite a bit more detail down the road. Article 4 laid out the relationship between the states and the United States. It established that fugitives from any one state could not seek refuge in another state. On its surface, this seems like an answer to that situation following Shays' rebellion, when many of the rebels, Daniel Shays included, managed to escape into New Hampshire. New Hampshire, much to the consternation of Massachusetts, was not interested in returning the rebels. Far darker, however, was the fact that this provision would not just include men like Shays, but also those who had escaped from bondage. This section would likewise lay out the aforementioned process for admitting new states and establishing that those states would be governed with a republican form of government. It also made abundantly clear that the federal government had an obligation to defend states from both outside invasion and domestic violence, something that was clearly a direct acknowledgement of the Confederation's failures during Shays' rebellion. Article 5 addressed the process for amending the Constitution, a process that would require the approval of 3/4 of the states. Article 6 established that debt from the Confederation would be honored by the Constitution, thus staving off further economic instability. It would also make clear that U.S. law was supreme, and that religious tests were not to be utilized for potential office holders anywhere in the United States. Article 7 covered the previously discussed process necessary for the ratification of the Constitution. It was going to take 9 states, and the question would be decided in state conventions. When the proposed Constitution came back from the Committee on Style, there was yet another day of bickering. A few more changes were made. The number of votes to overrule a presidential veto, for instance, changed from 3/4 to 2/3. But more or less, this was going to be the final product. There was a brief attempt by Roger Sherman to add a clause that no future amendment to the Constitution could alter a state's equality in the Senate. This indicates the very real fear that was still pervasive within the delegates, that at some point the bigger states might attempt a move against the smaller states. Although this motion was defeated, Governor Morris motioned for a similar provision with slightly different language, which would pass without objection. For some, however, all of this was far too little to get them on board. Perhaps nobody is more interesting to consider in this light than Edmund Randolph. Randolph made plainly clear that he would not be voting in favor of the Constitution. He feared that even with the changes that had taken place, it still gave far too much power to the National Congress. What Randolph wanted was for the Constitution to be sent to the states, not for ratification, but rather for a period of modification and suggestions. In his mind, the correct play was to send the Constitution to the states, get their ideas, and then hold a second convention to get the job done. The problem with this, however, is that everybody also understood that if they did this, it would likely doom the entire project. Sending it out to 13 states for suggestions was going to mean that there were going to be 13 often contradictory wish lists. Despite what Randolph wanted, therefore, everybody knew that this was going to be it. There would be some other key names that would refuse to sign the Constitution, and like George Mason and Elbridge Gerry, but it was Randolph's that would remain the most painful. The Virginia Plan, if you recall, was not something proposed by its chief architect, James Madison, but instead by Randolph. Randolph's defection proved to be a moment that deeply hurt Madison. He worried that Randolph's call for a second convention was a direct threat to the Republic itself. From Madison's point of view, their friendship could not survive Randolph becoming a threat to the government. Madison's writings reflect this fact and show that he understood that this was likely a rift that the men would not be able to bridge, either professionally or personally. I bring this up as a reminder that these delegates to the convention had given up a lot in order to be in that room. The convention would have very real consequences for all of them once they left it. On September 17th, 1787, the final version of the proposed Constitution was read aloud to the delegates. Well, almost the final version. Even now, after what was meant to be the final reading, Nathaniel Gorham made a final proposal that representation be changed from one representative per 40,000 people to one for every 30,000 people. Gorham got a big ally to his cause when George Washington, who had mostly just sat quietly presiding over the events, chimed in that he was in favor of this as well. This, as it turned out, was enough to convince the convention, and the final edit was made. With that, it was time for signatures. Hamilton made a final appeal to the remaining holdouts, trying to get them on board. However, it was pointless. Randolph, Gerry, and Mason all refused to put their name on the document. Joining them was Luther Martin, who left the convention without signing. Martin would, unsuccessfully, lead the fighting in Maryland against the ratification of the Constitution. Martin simply could never reconcile the lengths by which the convention had exceeded the authority granted to it by the Confederation Congress, and viewed the Constitution as no less than an illegal attempt to overthrow the legitimate Confederation. Despite this handful of delegates who had outright rejected the Constitution, as well as several others that had, for one reason or another, left the convention early, there was more than enough votes present to secure the necessary unity amongst the state delegations. The ink had been cast. The Constitution had been signed, and now it was going to be up to the individual states to decide just what they wanted to do with it. It was here, as Georgia, the final state to sign the document, was doing just that, that Benjamin Franklin would make his now famous comment about the sun on the back of Washington's chair. The sun on the chair was only half a sun, with the horizon painted along it. Franklin said that he had often wondered if he was looking at a rising sun or a setting sun. With Georgia signing after the completion of their work, only then did Franklin know that it was indeed a rising sun. The remainder of the night was spent together in celebration. Toasts were made, huzzas were huzzaed, and everybody was breathing a sigh of relief for what had truly been a difficult few months. Within a few days, the delegates were departing Philadelphia and were on their way home. Everybody was well aware that the real fight still lay ahead. Although they had reached what most considered to be a somewhat uneasy agreement on the Constitution, the real battle was always going to come during the ratification process. I'm going to leave the ratification process for the next few episodes, as that is going to become a very significant battle indeed. 9 of the 13 states were going to have to get on board. Although it was a number that many felt was achievable, there was still considerable worry that it was not going to be the case. For example, everybody was well aware that Rhode Island was going to be a very hard no. A state that fails to even bother sending a delegation was not going to enthusiastically endorse the Constitution. New York? Well, that was another question mark. Sure, Hamilton had signed as the state's lone signature. However, politically, Hamilton had been something of an outsider in the state's delegation. Recall that it was New York that had gone through the work of sending two men into the convention who were clearly opposed to sweeping changes coming to the system of government. Virginia, likewise, had just seen two of its most prominent citizens in George Mason and Governor Edmund Randolph decline to sign the Constitution. Let's also not forget about Patrick Henry, who, last we saw him, was about as staunchly opposed as anybody could be. As we are going to see, those feelings that Henry had not improved at all in these past 3 months. So although there was confidence in the eventual ratification of the Constitution, it was far from being a fait accompli. There certainly were dangers that still lie ahead for the Constitution. Now, traditionally, I would have an entire episode to take a retrospective look at the Constitution, examine how the people felt about it and what its legacy is. With the Constitution, however, I'm going to do things a little bit differently, because there really is no way to do a full-scale retrospective over what the document means. Because, well, that answer is basically going to be buried in the rest of this podcast. From this point forward, so much of what we are going to be doing here is examining the legacy of the Constitution. Because if the Constitution provides the framework for the government, then it must also provide the scaffolding in which this podcast is going to have to operate. With that being said, though, I do think there are a few things here that we can cover that will tie a bow on both our episode today and, more importantly, the Constitutional Convention. It is undeniable that you have to give a round of applause to a document that has managed to survive as long as it has with really only minimal changes. The staying power of the federal Constitution is extraordinary. The U.S. federal Constitution is indeed the oldest written constitution in the world. During that time, it has also been remarkably stable, having only been amended 27 times. Of those 27 times, 10 of them came in 1791 as the Bill of Rights. 17 amendments over 230 or so years? Well, that is a pretty impressive run of stable government. This kind of political stability has undoubtedly been a boon to the United States. It is the reason why the Constitution has become something akin to American scripture. Coming from the position of somebody who, as I imagine many of you listening were, was fully educated in the United States, the Constitution is often portrayed as something from a wiser generation. Something that, if not delivered from the peak of Mount Sinai, is pretty much the political modern equivalent. Although that may be overselling things a bit, it is not too much to say that for most in the United States, the document is revered. That stability that has so defined the Constitution has also, as we are going to see in depth as we move forward, made the document almost painfully inflexible. It would be disingenuous if we applaud the document for its stability while also ignoring the fact that the entire system is going to break down over the question of slavery. Decisions that were made during the summer months of 1787 would come back to have a catastrophic effect on the future of the country. The failure to more completely address slavery during the convention is one of its most dramatic and consequential shortcomings. The final product produced that September was also curiously lacking a Bill of Rights. Now, of course, we know that a Bill of Rights is on the horizon, and just a few years after the Constitution goes into effect, 10 amendments would be tacked on. This does, however, beg the question of why the original document in 1787 lacked any such declaration of rights. Such declarations were not unusual in 1787. of the 13 states, 8 of them had some kind of declaration of individual rights that were to be protected. George Mason, as unhappy as he was at the moment, was the author of the Virginia Bill of Rights. When fellow non-signer Elbridge Gerry proposed a Bill of Rights be added, Mason would second the motion. However, this debate seems to have seemingly been short, with little in the way of actual debate. Roger Sherman pointed out that the state constitutions can cover individual rights. The states quickly agreed, and just like that, a Bill of Rights, being in the original draft, died right there on the spot. This decision will come back to cause a whole lot of headaches amongst the delegates, because as we are going to see next time, during the ratification of the Constitution, the lack of a Bill of Rights was often used as a glaring red flag for the document's detractors. It's not as though the delegates were opposed to said rights. In fact, most of them would have been on board with it. It was more that many of the drafters thought that they simply were not necessary. Alexander Hamilton, for instance, believed that a Bill of Rights would be dangerous. His argument was that all the powers rested in the hands of the people, and that by explicitly stating which powers were retained by the people, it would act to undermine that principle. In other words, the people already have these protections. There is absolutely no reason we need to state it aloud. James Wilson viewed the Constitution as nothing more than a code for reference, rather than something that laid down the law of the land. If this was true, there was no point in including a Bill of Rights, as the Constitution merely laid out the boundaries of the law. Dr. Benjamin Rush, channeling Alexander Hamilton, argued during ratification that a Bill of Rights was pointless. Why did the Constitution need anything to state their inherent natural rights? They were inherent. You don't need to specifically enumerate them. In other words, these are rights that are granted by nature itself, not by any government. Therefore, such declarations of rights should have no place in the Constitution. Charles Pinckney in South Carolina called out the obvious. He pointed out that many such bills of rights began by declaring that all men were born free and equal, and that any such statement was absurd at best and dangerous at worst when you considered the large number of people being held in bondage. We are going to talk far more in the coming episodes about the Bill of Rights, as this is going to become a major subject during ratification. However, I wanted to give you the background today by laying out exactly why one did not exist from the beginning. The first part of the battle was over. Nobody was exactly thrilled with the outcome. Even among those who signed, many delegates thought that the Constitution was about the best they could do under the conditions. But the large number of compromises left everyone dissatisfied. He wrote to Thomas Jefferson that he believed that the decisions made would leave the states in a state of conflict with the federal government for the next 150 years, which he was not necessarily wrong about, although that relationship is going to be largely redefined during the Reconstruction era. Lingering problems over the question of states' rights are going to continue right up into the modern day. Jefferson, too, would write back to Madison that he too harbored serious concerns about the Constitution. Chief amongst his complaints was that lack of a Bill of Rights. Jefferson firmly believed that a direct defense of individual rights was something that was required in any modern system. He argued that inferences of rights were dangerous, and that it was a far better idea to just come out and clearly state their intentions. What existed, therefore, at the end of the Constitutional Convention was an uneasy agreement. Nobody thought that the Constitution was perfect, and pretty much everybody was walking away with a laundry list of complaints over compromises that had been reached, and a general concern that when their work reached the states, that ratification would prove too difficult a hill to climb. I mentioned a while ago that today in the United States, the Constitution is revered, seen by many as being essentially a piece of American scripture. I think it is probably fair to say that a revelation of future adulation would have been very surprising to all of them. If you were to have told that same group that some of their decisions would help lead to the Civil War, that may well have been far more believable for many of them. Next time, this uneasy agreement is going to face its biggest challenge. Before the Constitution can become the law of the land, it must first be ratified by 9 of the states. A task that is going to be anything but easy. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as the states debate ratification.